This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I've got a real mix for you. We'll talk with atmospheric scientist Charles Bardeen about the day the Earth burned. From Texas, I'll ask Grow Your Own Groceries gardener Marjorie Wildcraft about how she weathered Hurricane Harvey. We'll end with a shocking warning for the Northern Hemisphere from Danish scientist Jorgen Stephenson. But first, a sad voice from the front lines of climate change. The island of Dominica was a jewel in the Caribbean. All that green was wiped away by the Category 5 Hurricane Maria, powered by hotter-than-normal seas. Even as the islanders struggled out of the wreckage of their homes and lives, their prime minister made it to the United Nations in New York. He spoke these words to a nearly empty chamber where few cared about the end of Eden.
Mr. President, I come to you straight from the front line of the war on climate change. Mr. President, warmer air and sea temperatures have permanently altered the climate between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. Heat is the fuel that takes ordinary storms, storms we could normally muster or master in our sleep, and supercharges them into a devastating force. In the past, we would prepare for one heavy storm a year. Now, thousands of storms form on a breeze in the mid-Atlantic and line up to pound us with maximum force and fury. Before this century, no other generation had seen more than one Category 5 hurricane in their lifetime. In this century, this has happened twice, and notably, it has happened in the space of just 2 weeks. And may I add, Mr. President, that we are only midway into this year's hurricane season. In the case of Dominica, it has been only 2 years since we lost lives and endured substantial physical and infrastructural damage from the ravages of floods and mudslides of Tropical Storm Erica. Mr. President, to deny climate change is to procrastinate while the earth sinks. It is to deny a truth we have just lived. It is to mock thousands of my compatriots who, in a few hours, without a roof over their heads, will watch the night descend on Dominica in fear of sudden mudslides and what the next hurricane may bring. We as a country and as a region did not start this war against nature. We did not provoke it. The war has come to us. Mr. President, my fellow leaders, there is no more time for conversation. There is little time left for action. While the big countries talk, the small island nations suffer. We need action, and we need it now, Mr. President. We in the Caribbean do not produce greenhouse gases or sulfate aerosols. We do not pollute or overfish our oceans. We have made no contribution to global warming that can move the needle. But yet, we are among the main victims on the front line. In the Commonwealth of Dominica, we have long pursued and respected an existence that preserves our little Eden. The Mont Tropitans has been a national park for 40 years and a UNESCO World Heritage Site for 20. Our livelihoods are part of our ecosystem. This is how my people and my country earn and survive. But what is our reality at this moment? Pure devastation. As Dominicans bear the brunt of climate change, I repeat, we are shouldering the consequences of the actions of others, actions that endanger our very existence, and all for the enrichment of a few elsewhere. Mr. President, we dug graves today in Dominica. We buried loved ones yesterday, and I am sure that as I return home tomorrow, we shall discover additional fatalities as a consequence of this encounter. Our homes are flattened, our buildings roofless, our water pipes smashed, and road infrastructure destroyed. Our hospital is without power, and schools have disappeared beneath the rubble. Our crops are uprooted. Where there was green, there is now only dust and dirt. The desolation is beyond imagination. Mr. President, fellow leaders, the stars have fallen. Eden is broken.
That was a selection from the speech made September 27th by the Prime Minister of Dominica, Roosevelt Skirrit. Find a link to the whole speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Can anyone prepare for emergencies like Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? How did Texas preppers do in Hurricane Harvey? Whatever trying times may come, Marjorie Wildcraft has helped hundreds of thousands get on the pathway to resilience and a better life. Marjorie founded the Grow Network. She's the host of the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. Marjorie has been featured in National Geographic magazine. Her DVD series, Grow Your Own Groceries, is phenomenally popular, as are her many YouTube videos. Marjorie, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me back on. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I know that you and your family have a homestead in Central Texas. What did you experience of Hurricane Harvey?
Yeah, we had about 19 inches of rain come in about a little over a 24-hour period. We had actually prepared for a lot worse. And actually, our house is not that, you know, high above ground, and we've seen in the past where water could come in. And my husband had, last year, he had built a retaining wall and like a big French drain all around the house. Now, you got to realize that Texas has been in a drought for the last, I don't know how many years. So people were looking at him like he was nuts, you know, building this retaining wall and French drain. And then, of course, we came through the whole flooding just fine. There's no problems at all. The water diverted beautifully. You know, I mean, 19 inches of rain is a lot for anybody. And my friend said, how did he know? And I said, it's really simple. Texas weather is totally predictable. It's long periods of drought punctuated by severe flooding. So he knew it was coming. We've just had a long drought, you know. Central Texas, they had actually predicted it to be a lot worse, and Harvey didn't quite hit us as hard. But the coastal cities and then that reversal where it went into Houston, that was just really unexpected. And that was a really a much more horrific situation, which it could be interesting to see how that unfolds economically over the years. I know, I have a lot of family in South Florida also, and I know when Hurricane Andrew did such devastation in South Florida, I thought, oh, you know, what's going to happen here? Well, it turned out being a big boon to South Florida because all the insurance money that came flooding in. But in Houston, about 85% of the buildings and houses there that were flooded out did not have flood insurance. So I'm really going to be watching. I think this is going to be a lot harder of a hit economically, you know, just because of that aspect of it, right? There isn't the funding that's in place. You know, FEMA, forget it. We're not really getting much out of that, right?
Right. And, you know, the media's almost stopped covering it as they move on to the next big storm in Puerto Rico or something else, the NFL and Trump. And I'm worried about Houston. I'm worried that Americans won't pour in the support that's really needed in many ways.
I too am worried because that's a climate there where mold is, you know, even most of the floodwaters have drained off now, but there's, you know, you've got everything is saturated with water and mold is a huge issue. It's a, you know, Texas is still a very warm climate. You know, even last week we had, you know, up in the upper 90s, and in Houston that's the same temperature. Those are the ideal conditions. And then, of course, you know, Houston is this horrible environmental disaster waiting to happen with all the oil refineries and all the different things, you know, that can leak and get loose. And the chemical situation there. So I too, am very, very worried about Houston.
Did you hear of any examples where the prepper lifestyle helped Texans with Hurricane Harvey? What are they saying after that?
You know, I think that you have to have a prepper lifestyle always. You know, with the way things are changing so fast, and even if it's not going to be a natural disaster, if it's not going to be, economic collapse or something, like, it could just be personal. There were lots of people in 2008 that just lost a job or something, and that's devastating. So being prepared with having, some sources of food or, tradable skills or things that you can do, having some preparations in place and preparing that radical change can come is always a good idea. And the people who had prepared for this ahead of time, they fared much better. People who had already had stocks of sandbags to put around their house or things that they had done to make sure, like we did, to make sure that much water wasn't going to flood them out, they do much better. My family, as I said, I've got a lot of family, and my family down in South Florida especially, the power went out. It was out for more than a week where they lived, and, they had backup generator and a way to do water filtration and, rain catchment. Funny that you'd need that in a hurricane with so many inches coming at you, but you do, right? So all the things, backup food supplies. So, yes, in general, people who are prepared do better.
Here's one odd little point that you've just stimulated in my brain here. People forget when the power goes out or maybe the roof gets blown off that cooking isn't easy or possible. And for that, I really recommend storing rice. Rice can be soaked overnight and then you can eat it without cooking. It doesn't taste very good, but it keeps you alive.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great tip. And then, there's lots of little ways you can make stoves or get some firewood together or figure something out. But having maybe your normal propane tank with your barbecue grill, prepping doesn't have to be something extra. It can be something that you just have all the time as a part of your lifestyle, right? So having the grill and always having an extra tank on hand, that's just, it just makes sense. Don't let your fuel get in your tank in your car, less than half a tank, right? So you've always got, that was another thing that was fascinating was, I think it just blew up on social media. They were talking about, the refineries are going to shut down. And it just within hours, all the gas stations had these huge, huge lines. And it was really unnecessary. But, those flash mob type things can really get out of hand with the social media and all the instant messaging and texting we have with our cell phone systems now.
I remember in New England when Hurricane Irene hit there, it was in August in 2011, and that flooded out a lot of homes, but it also flooded out a lot of gardens. How can you prepare gardens for the kind of rain that you got with Harvey?
The way we prepared was I have my gardens on a bit of a hillside so that I know the water is going to drain off well. But you do have to be prepared, and one way to prepare is to have multiple food sources. I'll tell you a story of I went to the Permaculture Institute, which is a group that's just north of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I went there because they had this old established food forest, these old apricot trees and apple trees and all these beautiful fruit and nut trees that had been producing for years, and they had this little irrigation system that they would divert water and flood irrigate them from time to time. They loved that, and that was like their primary thing. But they also had some livestock. They had goats and sheep and chickens, and that was another food source for them. But they weren't real big on the annual gardens. It wasn't a part of their thing. The permaculturists often tend to want to focus toward perennials and toward meat. Well, and I was there with Arena Putman, just really delightful woman who runs it with Scott. And one winter, they had a freak storm that got to, like, I don't know, some negative number, right, below zero. And their old trees didn't die, gratefully. They were large diameter trees. But it did, all the younger growth on the most of the branches did die off, and they did not have any production for at least a year because the trees were severely, set back with that cold of a temperature. And Arena, she was like, you really do need to have annual gardens because you can get something up and going and, some crops in depending in just a month, but others in 3 months. So You really want to have diversity, is my belief. Also, as a gardener, I would say, you know, you get wiped out from time to time with a garden, regardless of flooding. You know, sometimes just some strange insect thing will happen, or, you know, that bizarre freeze you didn't expect. And that's happening more and more, interestingly enough. I'm getting reports from gardeners and farmers around the world that, with the weather patterns changing, you just have to recognize that we're starting to see more bizarre losses. And getting used to that, planting for resilience, right?
And having the seeds around to replace what you can do, and knowing how to grow things that grow fast, like bok choy or whatever, things are going to produce for you pretty quickly if you have to replace a garden.
Yeah, that's it. Having the seeds is a wonderful thing, but really the experience is much more valuable. But seed saving is definitely an important piece of that.
Now, you've got a kind of interactive video series going with your Grow Network folks to get a new book ready. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm writing a book, and it's called Grow, All True Wealth Comes from the Ground. And something you may not have known about me is years ago, I don't know if you've ever heard of Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yes.
But years before he became famous, I was a student of his. And it was when I was an expat living out in Asia. This is before husband and children. I was footloose and fancy free out in Asia, having a good time, doing all this consulting work. And my friend said, "You got to check out this crazy guy, Robert Kiyosaki." And I went, like, "Wow, this guy is really making some sense here." So let me tell you. So I was one of the distinctions that I got from Robert was, you know, even as a consultant, I was just making money per hour. Right. And I wanted to learn how to have money make money. So I became a professional investor. And that's when I moved back to the U.S. And I was doing that for a while and doing really, really well with it. And then I predicted, and this was in the early 2000s, I predicted that what happened in 2008 was going to happen. I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, we're borrowing all this money from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and their business model just doesn't look good to me. And I'd not only put all my money into this investment thing, but I had investors, right? You know, OPM, right? Other people's money. And people had trusted me. And we had this whole thing, the corporation and all these limited partnerships. And I went to all my investors and I said, look, I really think that this whole thing is going to come apart. I think we need to unwind this whole real estate business, because if you're going to be successful in real estate, you're going to be borrowing a lot of money. And we did. We were managing, I think, about $8 to $10 million in debt at that time. And so I managed to convince all of them to unwind it. And it took a couple of years, and we completely unwound that business. And that's when I started saying, what happens during economic collapse? And I was so grateful that I was actually early with my forecast, because we had pretty much unwound everything by 2003. And, of course, we all know that 2008 was when it happened. But I also, in that journey of like really unwinding that and looking at money and the whole thing, and I began to realize wealth really isn't about money, which is, you know, something I think we all know at some level. But for me, I really got it in a big way. So I'm writing this book all about what real wealth is, which is completely contrary to everything Robert Kiyosaki taught. So, you know, it's not about real estate and bank accounts and fast cars, but it's really about your health, right? You know, what if you're wealthy, if you have a ton of money, what good is that if you're coughing and hacking and you've got to go around with an oxygen thing or an IV on your arm, right? You know, having your health is way more important than having a lot of money. Family. You know, how having a loving family, you know, a husband or wife, that you great relationships and good times with your kids and community, and having a group of people that you regularly interact with and support and work with, and they do the same with you. And then meaningful work, doing something that's really like a part of your life purpose. That's a form of wealth. And then the final thing is really coming into your life purpose and living from that. That is the ultimate wealth. So this is all a book about those five things. And Alex, all of them can come from the ground. You know, your health is absolutely something you can grow yourself. And a healthy family, all of our family traditions really come from mealtimes, eating together. And when you do things together, like do things with your kids, you know, you can go to the roller skating rink, or you can go to the movies. But if you take your kids in a garden and go maybe collect eggs or, you know, do something like that, I guarantee you that those memories are going to stay with them, and the bond between you will be much deeper than the roller skating rink, right? And then working with your community, growing food together with other people is unbelievably, you know, it develops bonds and relationships that you'll never get just by joining the bowling league or, you know, whatever other forms of community that were your Facebook friends, right? And then meaningful work, we have completely got to reimagine and recreate the entire food supply and the entire medical system that we have. The industrial medical system is, quite frankly, just killing people. So we need a bevy of trained herbalists and nutritionists and, you know, chiropractors and people to grow herbs and people to make tinctures and all the different aspects of health that even way beyond what I'm even imagining or discussing here. And the same thing with food. We really have to have more people producing food, meaningful food, cottage industry, local food, you know, animal products, vegetables. So the whole, and then of course, you know, all the processing that goes with that of the making of the fermented vegetables and all the, you know, kimchi and kombucha and all the different things that you do with the food things. So we have got, to recreate an entire food system and an entire medical system that's based on something that's real and holistic and sustainable. And in that is opportunities for tremendous amounts of meaningful work, right? Going to work every day, you know, growing food or going to work every day growing medicine or going to work every day making medicine or healing with people or, you know, setting up a distribution system for local foods or, you know, the different ways that you can work. That is so meaningful. I'll tell you right now, with the Grow Network, we have just brought on our 8th full-time employee. And anytime, this is how hungry people are for meaningful work, because the Grow Network, the purpose of the Grow Network is to stop the destruction of the earth, right?
Right.
And our catalyzing statement is homegrown food on every table. Commercial agriculture is the most destructive force on the planet. We are absolutely desertifying vast areas of this planet in for the sake of growing corn, soybeans, and wheat. And so people want meaningful work. And when I put out and say, look, I'm looking for an affiliate manager, or I'm looking for even an IT guy or, you know, an editor or whatever, we get a minimum of about 300 applicants. People really want to do things that are meaningful. There's a real hunger for that. And, you know, we all know that things have got to change. Why not create work and do work that's meaningful? Right? God, there's nothing worse than going to work just for a paycheck. Isn't that terrible?
It is, but I've done it. We've done it. But I now am doing something that I really love and believe in. I'm doing self-sufficient radio EcoShock, and that's what you're tuned to hear. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Marjorie Wildcraft. She's the Texas homesteader who founded the Grow Network, and she also hosts the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. Now, I watched your DVD series, and now I hear that it's being used by people much beyond American homesteaders. How does the homegrown tech that you're developing get communicated and applied in other countries? Maybe you talked about missionary organizations, but how is it being used in the developing world?
Yeah, there are missionary organizations that are using the video. There's also a lot that's happening in South America with it. I'm so surprised, and they're translating it. You know, I created all of that in my homestead in Central Texas, and I got to tell you a little story about it. When we first bought it, you know, we didn't know anything really about growing food. I mean, I don't have any background in growing food. Like I said, I was a money manager and before that I was an engineer, right? And we fell in love with this piece of land that has terrible soil. It's just sandy soil, no water, you know. And then Central Texas has like this insane climate that changes all the time. In fact, Peter Bain of the Permaculture Activist magazine, he said, Marjorie, you're actually located in the perfect spot to figure out how to grow food for all the rest of us when climate change becomes a huge reality for everyone else. And it's all changing so much all the time, and nobody has any soil or water. And I said, thank you, Peter. Now that I know better, I think I would like to move somewhere else. But we created that there. And what I began to realize was that there are principles of growing food. And one of the principles is you really do need good soil. Most of us who don't grow any food at all, we just think that that's there to hold the plant up, right? You know, the seed packet says put it in the ground and water it and come back in 90 days and get your broccoli. It doesn't talk anything about good soil, but you really need good soil. And it took me a long time to realize that principle. And that principle is applicable everywhere. It's applicable in Africa. It's applicable in New Zealand. It's applicable in Ireland, in Montana, in Toronto, you know, in Texas. And I think that's why the DVD has had such wide appeal, is because I showed how I implemented it in Texas, but the principles are all throughout the whole video that are applicable anywhere. Yes, and we've had university organizations use it as a part of some coursework. And definitely groups, and I do, there's one group in South America that I'm thinking of. Actually, it was in Cuba. I went to Cuba quite a few years ago and left them a bunch of videos, and they are working also quite quickly on sustainable agriculture. They've been doing a lot for years since they had their collapse, and they really appreciated it there. What groups often do is there's like 8 sections to the video, and often they'll watch one section, and it, you know, which will be, you know, a 10 or 15 minute section, and then their group locally will talk about, you know, well, Marjorie used that species because she's in Texas. What is the equivalent plants we have in our region? Or, you know, she talked about this, or who has that in the neighborhood? You know, or, you know, like she used these kind of chickens because they're used to tolerating heat, but, you know, we're up here in Maine, and different varieties of chickens are going to do better in the cold. And, you know, what food, you know, so they translated into their region, and it's a great networking thing too, because, oh, you know, so-and-so Bob down the road, he's got those chickens like that, right? You know, let's go see if we can get some from him. So I've been really surprised. I was really surprised and shocked at the success of the video, to be honest with you, Alex, because really, I mean, it's a video about growing food, right? You know, like, who would have thought a video like that would go viral?
Well, I used it. I watched your calculations about water storage from the roof, and I installed a 250-gallon water tank to catch our eaves trough water. And when we got into a drought situation here this year where the water levels got so low, they said, you're going to have to stop watering your garden. I would never do that. That's my grocery store. But I had this extra rainwater collected, and that was just enough to get me through until it rained again.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, those calculations are applicable everywhere on the planet. So, yeah.
Now, can a city dweller play this grow-your-own-food game, or do we have to wait until we get out into the country?
I would encourage everybody everywhere to start growing some food. And if you're a city dweller, there's lots of options. So, you know, one is try to get into the community garden if you possibly can. In fact, that's one of the best ways, because that's where the other experienced people are that can help you get up to speed quicker. I know that a lot of community gardens have waiting lists now. So, and then there are lots of rooftop garden options. That's one thing you want to be careful of, that, you know, you're not putting too much weight up there. So check with the owner of the building. But there are lots and lots of buildings. I saw a statistic recently that there were 44,000 acres of usable with enough sunlight and structurally correct rooftop area in New York City. I was like, wow, they could be growing a ton of food up there. And they're starting to grow some. They got some greenhouses and things going on different building tops. There's, of course, also the, you know, your patio or your balcony or whatever room you can find. There's also, you know, you can just do some things indoors. There's some really nice little planters that I like that are, you know, maybe only about 3 or 4 square feet. They're not that big, but you can grow probably a half a dozen lettuces or so. And, you know, if you get them, the key thing with that would be to make sure that that soil is really rich with nutrition. You're not going to get a lot of calories out of it, but a lot of people are malnourished. So eating nutrition-rich lettuce might be, you know, it's going to make that nourishment more bioavailable from you and for you, and much, much better than vitamins.
Yeah, we had one fellow in North Vancouver who became an urban farmer by finding people who didn't really want to look after their own backyards, and he took over a whole series of backyards, started doing planting, grew crops that he sold commercially, and made a living out of it.
Well, that was going to be my next suggestion, is there are some websites out there. I think sharedearth.com is one, where they're hooking up people that have some land with people that want to do it. And I think that's awesome. You know, there's lots of folks that say, hey, I've got a yard, and if you want a garden, come here and do that, and, you know, maybe give me a share or not or whatever, you know. I know Joel Salatin, who is known as America's Farmer, he was like, you don't even need land to farm. You know, there's so much land out there that people would love you to farm on it because they want the agricultural exemption. And they'll lease it to you for a song. So, you know, there's lots of Carol Deppe, probably one of the most astute writers. She's the one who wrote The Resilient Gardener and also Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties. I mean, this woman is really teaching you how to grow food in preparation for a collapse-type scenario. She has never owned her own land. She's always just, rented a plot from here or there or whatever, and yet she's been growing her own food for 40 years.
So what community options does your own network offer?
Yeah, you know, we are just starting to get some features built up for that. We are looking at setting up a whole marketplace area where people can connect up. You know, it's kind of funny what a request we get all the time that I need to, that we're going to set up for is I get a lot of people who go, hey, Marjorie, you know, I'm a 45-year-old woman and I love to garden and I'm looking for a mate. I'm looking for a guy. Even some singles. Like, I get so many requests for singles. I'm like, you know, we got to get this marketplace and have a single section, but and also a seed swap section, you know, varieties of seeds that you've been saving, as well as another request we get commonly from people is, I've got this beautiful property. I've been growing organic on it for years, and I just want to make sure that who I sell it to is really going to be somebody who, you know, who cares for the earth and is going to treat it that way. And do you have any real estate listing? So I've got my web developer, my IT guy. We're hoping to roll that out actually next month is the marketplace. So I'll, you know, go over to grownetwork.com and sign up for our newsletter, and you'll be the first to know when the marketplace becomes available.
Do you have any other projects you want to tell us about?
I do. We are working on, you know, the overuse of antibiotics is a huge, huge issue. And our population worldwide has become utterly dependent on the use of pharmaceutical antibiotics. And then I think you're well aware of the super bugs. So there's all kinds of bacteria and whatever that, like penicillin was this miracle drug for the first decade or two that it was out. And then now it's essentially useless. And in fact, the bacteria that overcame penicillin have mutated into, I think it's MRSA, and the MRSA bacteria, which is now even more potent and harder and difficult. So more and more, I think the CDC in the United States, the Center for Disease Control, estimates that about 23,000 people a year will die in the United States alone from infections that cannot be treated anymore with antibiotics. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The pharmaceutical companies, I don't know why they're not developing new antibiotics, but they aren't. And there aren't any new antibiotics in the pipeline. Actually, it's probably a good thing because we don't need more antibiotics. But there really is. Maybe it may not be profitable. I mean, if you think about it, you spend so much money to develop one of these, and then it's only effective for a decade or two. It may not be worth their while to actually create any of these. I think the bacteria are also mutating faster, you know, real, and the World Health Organization, I mean, some of these organizations I'm not exactly enthralled with, but they are making statements like, this is serious. I think Margaret Chan is the director of the World Health Organization. She said, you know, there's a time when a cut finger on a child may possibly kill that child or a sore throat, or, you know, we're heading into an era where antibiotics don't work anymore. So, personally, I have always done the best I can to avoid antibiotics, the pharmaceutical ones, and over the years I've been using other techniques. Now, you know, people have been getting cut up and wounded and whatever for, like, well, ever since there's been humans, right? I mean, you think of all those movies, those biblical movies in Greece and Rome, and they're fighting each other with those swords and all that stuff, and you know, not all of those guys died just because they had a wound. They had methods of treating people when they got lacerations or infections, and not everybody survived, but they definitely had very effective techniques and ancient ancestral medicine, and it works. When my first boy was about 1 year old, I got mastitis in my breast, which if it weren't treated, that's a lethal thing, right? And we treated it with a poultice of, you know, different cabbage and ginger and things, and used basic poulticing techniques and treated it just fine. I've had massive conjunctivitis in my eye. I've had tooth, abscess tooth. My husband was very nervous about that. He said, "Hon, those are infections that are right close to your brain. You need to go." And I'm like, "No, I think we can do this at home." And we did. Most recently, about 2 years ago, I got bit by a copperhead snake when I was out harvesting some tomatoes and just treated the whole thing at home. So there are these really effective techniques. And you don't want to start treating a snake bite right out of the get-go, right? When you, if you want to use this ancestral medicine, you need to start with something small, like, you know, you get a little cut or something like that, right? Or, you know, somebody has a little sprain or there's a minor injury, right? You don't want to start out trying to cure cancer, right? You want to start out with small things and gain your confidence and learn how to use this medicine, start getting more comfortable with it. And yeah, then, you know, and wean yourself from the pharmaceutical antibiotics. Here's another fascinating thing. In the U.S., and I, you know, to all of our listeners globally, I'm sure you can translate into your own numbers, but there's about 1 million joint replacements a year, and that's only expected to increase because of especially the baby boomer population doesn't have such good posture, and I think that's the main reason why we have so many joint problems, that people have just been abusing their joints by walking and sitting in all these crazy positions. But regardless, all those kind of surgeries are going to become riskier and riskier and riskier because pharmaceutical antibiotics are not going to be available. So you are not going to want to go under the knife if, you know, if the possibility of infection is, and then the possibility of not ever being able to treat that infection is an issue, right? So when they talk about the antibiotics apocalypse, they really mean it. And so I met a wonderful healer, and a lot of your local herbalists will know these skills, but I met this wonderful herbalist who's been living on the wilderness for the past 20 years. He comes in to buy stuff and trade for things and all that, and now he's come back because he's really wanting to spend more time. But he has treated all kinds of things. You know, he runs into hikers out there that have sprained their legs or broken their arm or whatever, and he treats them with just plants and things that are out there. And very effectively. And Doug is where I learned a lot of the medicine that I've learned. And I said, "Doug, we're gonna make a video about this, about how to treat infection." So we did. We've created a product, and it'll teach you. It's mostly about external infections. So, you know, snake bites, spider bites, lacerations, you know, like a sprained ankle or a you know, broken bone. Those kind of infections, you know, if you're getting any kind of cut and you're seeing those red streaks, this would be medicine to treat it. And it's effective. I mean, I've been using it for years, and I really feel that we need to go back to that.
Well, and I think, too, if we can return to the grow-your-own-food aspect, if we build up our immune systems by having all those microchemicals and small little things that our body needs to really be whole. And I think that my own health has improved a lot since I'm eating out of my garden instead of the grocery store.
Yeah. Malnutrition is the elephant in the room, right? We say, you think of malnutrition and your average person in North America is going to think, "Oh, those poor, you know, Africans," and right? No. most of North America is malnourished. You know, well, your average American is malnourished. Your average Mexican, my God, the Mexicans are like way worse than the Americans in terms of obesity and diabetes and all these diseases that have to do with consumption of this really terrible food supply that we have. You're absolutely right, you know, and getting the right nutrients, because it's just not in the commercial food supply.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there, Marjorie. I've so much enjoyed talking with you again. And just for those who have tuned in, we've been talking with Texas homesteader, prepper, and skills teacher Marjorie Wildcraft. I've watched her Grow Your Own Groceries DVD, and I'm applying some of those tips around my home and garden. You can start with Marjorie's excellent YouTube videos and connect with others on the resilience path through thegrownetwork.org, thegrownetwork.org. Marjorie, thanks so much. It's been really a treat to talk with you again.
Alex, I sure appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Life on Earth is full of surprises. One peaceful day, 66 million years ago, in a climate quite like our own, an asteroid crashed into what we now call the Gulf of Mexico. Nothing has been the same since. New science published this summer in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has shed light on this mysterious catastrophe. To see what we can learn, I've reached the lead author, Dr. Charles G. Bardeen. He's a project scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Charles, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I think this paper contains a lot of useful science about our atmosphere and unexpected climate detours. Charles, what hit the Earth millions of years ago?
Well, what we've seen in the ocean is a crater that's about 100 kilometers in diameter, and that suggests an asteroid of about 10 kilometers in diameter. And it was likely composed of a rocky material, but it could have been iron.
And we have no idea where it came from. I mean, it just came from space one day.
Correct.
And what happened in the first couple of days after it hit?
So when it first hit, it would have created very high pressures at the surface that would have vaporized both the asteroid itself and the material at the surface. So you would have had vaporized rock. You would have created gases like CO2 and water vapor. Some of this, you would also have pulverized rock from the impact, so you would have had rock debris and water being splashed over large areas, as well as going up into the atmosphere. The vaporized material would travel all around the Earth, and as it comes back in, it would have cooled and formed particles that we call spherules that we can see in the sedimentary record. These small rocky particles, as they enter the atmosphere, would have gotten very hot, and that heat would have broiled animals that were at the surface and would have started large wildfires, global or near global scale wildfires. And those wildfires would have put soot into the atmosphere, high up into the atmosphere. The impact of the asteroid would also have triggered tsunamis, large waves propagating away from the origin of the impact. It could have also triggered earthquakes and could have triggered volcanic eruptions, and the volcanic eruptions could have put more gases into the atmosphere.
So what tools did you use to estimate the rapid changes to the atmosphere in such a short period, many millions of years ago?
So the main tool that we used is a climate model, the Community Earth System model, which is a model here at NCAR. That's a model that we use to study climate change, and we adapted that model to handle the large changes that came along with this event.
And so you got some of the input from geologic changes that we can actually find in the record of the rocks.
That's correct. So the main thing that we wanted to include in the model was the soot from the forest fires, because that's a particle that is very strongly absorbing, and of the things that might have been injected into the atmosphere, like the sulfate aerosols or dust, the soot would have had the strongest effect. And that is something that we have an estimate from the sedimentary record. So our colleagues, Wolbach and all, they dug into the sediments dated back to that time period and did microscopic analysis to look at how much soot was in that layer and estimated the size of the particles that were in that layer. And some of these particles were very small size that could have stayed in the atmosphere for a prolonged period. And so those were the particles that it was important for us to include in our model. And they had estimates ranging from 15,000 to 30,000 teragrams.
Which is just a gigantic amount of carbon and soot. I mean, it's unimaginable how much went up there.
That's correct.
And that darkened the sun.
It did. And because soot is very absorbing of sunlight, that heated the atmosphere where that soot was located and caused that soot to rise up into the stratosphere. And that's a part of the atmosphere that is outside of our normal weather. And so particles there can remain for a long period of time before they fall out. And so that's what we wanted to do in our model, was to see how long that would last, what effect that would have on both the surface and the chemistry in the upper atmosphere.
Were plants able to survive down on the Earth's surface during the period that soot was up there?
Plants on land would likely have been burned by the global fires, and then the darkness was sufficient to stop photosynthesis. So it's unlikely that plants would have regrown quickly from seed or from root if they had survived the fires. Likewise, in the ocean, without any sunlight, plants aren't going to grow, and so phytoplankton would have suffered, and that would have been catastrophic for the food chain in the ocean.
So how long did the Earth stay in that darkness before photosynthesis could start up again?
Our estimates are just under 2 years, about 18 months, 19 months.
Wow. Okay, so this asteroid hit is classified then as a mass extinction event, I presume?
Yes, this is one of the five mass extinction events, and it's the one that's most recent historically, so that's the one that we have the most evidence about.
So tell us about the changes to the ozone layer after this asteroid struck and about the ultraviolet rays.
So because this soot went into the stratosphere, that's where our protective ozone layer resides. It heated up the stratosphere, and that heating caused an increase in a chemical reaction that destroys ozone. In addition, the tropopause, the boundary between the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, and the stratosphere, got warm, and water that normally would not go into the stratosphere ended up making it into the stratosphere, making the stratosphere very wet, and that created more what we call HOX, which has a catalytic reaction that also destroys ozone. So there were two mechanisms to destroy ozone, and so ozone levels got very low, equivalent to a global ozone hole. However, this didn't cause immediate problems at the surface in terms of UV radiation because we also had the soot in the atmosphere at the same time. So while we weren't protected at the surface from UV by ozone, we were protected at the surface by soot. But as that soot fell out, it took longer for the ozone to recover. And so there was a period of about 2 years where we experienced very high ultraviolet at the surface, and that would have lasted for about 2 years and would have been about three times the normal amount of UV radiation at the surface. And there was a paper by a colleague, Betty Piarazzo, who used this type of model looking at an ocean impact of a 1 kilometer asteroid, and then we did a 1 kilometer impact on land. You don't get enough soot there to block photosynthesis, but you do get cooling about 4 Kelvin in the case of the 1 kilometer impact on land, and then you get much more extreme UV from both of those cases because you don't have as much soot blocking, or in the water impact, you don't have soot at all, but you still destroy the ozone.
Did I hear that the stratosphere is getting wetter now or is cooling now? What's the status of it?
Yeah, so global warming implies that you also have a cooling in the stratosphere.
Why?
The CO2 that goes into the atmosphere is a greenhouse gas, so it traps radiation at the surface, but it also in the upper atmosphere radiates to space, so it can cool the upper atmosphere.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, you've also studied the effects of volcanic activity on the upper atmosphere. Have volcanic emissions been steady over the last 100 years?
I personally haven't actually done studies with volcanoes, but volcanoes are a variable source of sulfates SO2 into the atmosphere that form sulfate aerosols. So you have periods with big eruptions, and then recently we've had periods where we haven't had large eruptions, but we have had small eruptions that have put significant amounts of SO2 into the atmosphere.
So in a way, this latest paper that we're talking about is a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is that when almost everything above water burned in a fireball and the sun went out for a couple of years, life did survive and it came back to thrive, although different forms of life. But the bad news is that an asteroid could strike Earth again. I know the moon and many planets are pockmarked with strikes from outer space. Isn't it always possible we could get hit again?
It is possible, and so NASA has a program to try to monitor for that, to look for some of these big asteroids and understand what their trajectories are, and so we don't know of any that would intersect with the Earth. We had one called Florence that just went by a few days ago that is about half the size of what we think hit in the Yucatan, and half the size means eighth of the energy. So that wouldn't have been sufficient to have caused global fires and the same amount of destruction and extinction that we saw in our simulations.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Charles Bardeen, the atmospheric scientist from the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. Your work reminds me of other science about massive dust after a nuclear war. Do you think there's a relationship or lessons to be learned there?
Yeah, the same kind of modeling framework that we used for this study has also been used to look at what might happen after a nuclear war. And it's the fires from the nuclear war that would put soot into the atmosphere, just like the asteroid would put soot into the atmosphere. The amounts of soot would be far less. So one study looked at a regional nuclear war, say like an India-Pakistan type of exchange, and that's 5 teragrams of soot. But it still had global consequences, not to the extent that we saw in our study. The surface cooling there was more like 1 degree instead of 15 degrees of cooling, and it wouldn't have put enough soot in the atmosphere to block photosynthesis. But it could have affected the length of growing seasons and caused famine and other serious problems. There's also been studies that have looked at larger amounts, between 50 and 150 teragrams of soot that you might get from a global nuclear war. So that would be something like a U.S.-Russia event. And there you would get a cooling of about 4 degrees to maybe 8 degrees for the 150 teragram event. And so those would have increased stress on our ability to grow food.
Now, it's my limited understanding, I'm not a scientist, that the weather happens in the troposphere lower down and doesn't really affect the stratosphere. But I'm wondering, I mean, Hurricane Irma was so large it shook the Earth. It showed up on seismic monitors. Can a major weather system influence the stratosphere, or is there a limit to that near-term weather disturbance?
Yes, weather can affect the upper atmosphere. Large fires can put soot into the stratosphere. Something like one of these hurricanes can put water vapor into the upper atmosphere and can also cause dynamical disturbances in the upper atmosphere.
So what got you into studying the mysteries of the atmosphere?
Well, I was a software engineer for about 20 years and decided I wanted a new challenge that was more rewarding and went back to school and got my PhD and got involved in climate modeling. This project was one of those interesting events to study.
Where do you see your research going next?
Well, we're interested in taking this back to the Cretaceous time period. So the model that we used was set up for present-day conditions because it takes more work to get a model set up for the Cretaceous. You have to run the ocean for hundreds or 1,000 years to get it initialized to those conditions. But I have colleagues that I'm working with who have such a model, and we're going to combine these together so that we can get a more accurate understanding of what would have happened in various locales. So where people have fossil records, we can get a better estimate of what the temperatures would have been like in those areas. And then I'm also going to be getting involved in some nuclear winter studies where we're going to use this type of a model to understand both the small-scale regional wars and the large-scale wars and trying to understand what those impacts could be so we can inform policymakers of the risks involved.
I'll be looking forward to that work. From the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, we've been talking with atmospheric scientist Charles G. Bardeen. He's the lead author of a new paper in PNAS titled On Transient Climate Change at the Cretaceous-Paleogene Boundary Due to Atmospheric Soot Injections. You can find helpful links about this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Charles, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith. We hear warnings from expert scientists, and then there's this. The invaluable Peter Sinclair caught up with Danish ice scientist Jorgen Peter Stephensen and posted a 5-minute video. You need to hear it.
The last 11,000 years, that's since the Ice Age, this our interglacial period has been unreasonably stable. And we don't know why. With an enhanced greenhouse effect from burning of fossil fuel, CO2 and methane and so on, you would have a gradual increase in temperature. That's what all the models show you. It's sort of a gradual increase in temperature. But that's assuming that the climate plays nice. And we actually know from the ice cores that the climate does not play nice all the time. Right now, by emitting greenhouse gases, we are doing the same with the climate system as the investment banks in the U.S. did when they were selling subprime loans in the economy in 2006 and 7. In the last million years, there's been a cycle of approximately 10 ice ages. And they were sort of around 90,000 years long, each of them. And then there was an interglacial period separating the ice ages of about 10,000 years. That's sort of the standard rule of events in the last million years. If we then zoom in on an ice age, you see that inside an ice age, the climate is extremely unstable. And you have this sequence of abrupt climate changes that happen basically from one year to the next. And it swings from semi-cold to very cold, semi-cold to very cold, within very short spaces of time. But each of these cycles is about a couple of thousand years long. And we had that 26th time in the last ice age. All the big cultures in India, China, Mesopotamia, Egypt, South America, all came after the ice age. So we are assuming that this is the standard. Our collective memory refers to this as this is normal. And maybe by enhancing our emissions of greenhouse gases, we are actually tipping the climate system to become yet unstable again as it used to be. We can face a climate change that happens just as sudden as a financial crisis. We have tons of examples of climate changes where we see complete reorganization of the atmospheric circulation from one year to the next. And that will be extremely hurtful for any agricultural activity in the world, because the weather will change and will not change back. Fast climate transitions, these abrupt climate changes that we see recorded in the ice age, they were discovered in the Greenland ice cores. But now they keep finding them everywhere in the marine sediments, wherever they look. But when it comes to Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, you don't see them. What you see there, it's also a wiggly climate line, but opposite. So when it's warm in Greenland, Antarctica cools off. And when it's cold in Greenland, Antarctica warms up. So these abrupt climate changes, it's an internal oscillation in the Earth climate system. What if what we do now is introducing so much fresh water into the North Atlantic that the North Atlantic current would sort of stop? That would make it terribly cold in Denmark, where I come from, because all of Northern Europe is placed at completely unreasonable latitudes. Just because of we have the North Atlantic current, we have remote heating, so to say. If that's going to be switched off, we're getting very, very cold. But still, the Earth could get warmer on average. It's just a distribution problem now. In principle, there's no reason why the Earth could not get warmer, but still Northern Europe and North America could get cold. Still, that area is not large compared to the global area. What we know from the sudden climate changes in the past is that these abrupt changes represent a reconfiguration of the entire atmospheric pattern. What if, with the emission of greenhouse gases, that we trigger a situation when this system all of a sudden goes into a feedback? If you reconfigure the transport patterns of high pressures and low pressure systems over North America and, for instance, Europe, but particularly North America and the Midwest, and all of a sudden it stops to rain, and it hits the Midwest and the U.S., and it leads to massive crop failure, that's going to impact the entire world. We don't know. We don't know where the threshold is. But we are rats inside the experiment.
That was Jorgen Peder Steffensen, recorded by Peter Sinclair, the founder of ClimateCrocs.com. The title is Inside the Experiment: The Climate Does Not Always Play Nice. It was published October 3rd. Find a link to the video in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Thank you, Peter, for your dedication. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and letting yourself into the awful truth. Let's keep trying.